Chapter 28. Avellanos. Don Jose, lifting up his voice, cried out to them over the high back of his chair. Sulaco has answered by sending today an army upon his flank. If all the other provinces show only half as much patriotism as we Occidentals, a great outburst of acclamations covered the vibrating treble of the life and soul of the party. Yes. Yes. This was true. A great truth. Sulaco was in the forefront, as ever. It was a boastful tumult, the hopefulness inspired by the event of the day breaking out amongst those caballeros of the campo, thinking of their herds, of their lands, of the safety of their families. Everything was at stake. No. It was impossible that Montero should succeed. This criminal, this shameless indio. The clamor continued for some time, everybody else in the room looking towards the group, where Don Juste had put on his air of impartial solemnity, as if presiding at a sitting of the provincial assembly. Decadent had turned round at the noise, and, leaning his back on the balustrade, shouted into the room with all the strength of his lungs, "Gran Bestia!" This unexpected cry had the effect of stilling the noise. All the eyes were directed to the window with an approving expectation. But Deckard had already turned his back upon the room, and was again leaning out over the quiet street. "This is the quintessence of my journalism. That is the supreme argument," he said to Antonia. I have invented this definition, this last word on a great question. But I am no patriot. I am no more of a patriot than the capitas of the Sulaco cargadores, this genius who has done such great things for this harbor, this active usher in of the material implements for our progress. You have heard Captain Mitchell confess over and over again that till he got this man he could never tell how long it would take to unload a ship. That is bad for progress. You have seen him pass by after his labors on his famous horse, to dazzle the girls in some ballroom with an earthen floor. He is a fortunate fellow. His work is an exercise of personal powers. His leisure is spent in receiving the marks of extraordinary adulation. And he likes it too. Can anybody be more fortunate? To be feared and admired is and are these your highest aspirations, Don Martin? Interrupted Antonia. I was speaking of a man of that sort, said Deckard, curtly. The heroes of the world have been feared and admired. What more could he want? Deckard had often felt his familiar habit of ironic thought fall shattered against Antonia's gravity. She irritated him, as if she too had suffered from that inexplicable feminine obtuseness which stands so often between a man and a woman of the more ordinary sort. But he overcame his vexation at once. He was very far from thinking Antonia ordinary, whatever verdict his skepticism might have pronounced upon himself. With a touch of penetrating tenderness in his voice he assured her that his only aspiration was to a felicity so high that it seemed almost unrealizable on this earth. She colored invisibly, with a warmth against which the breeze from the Sierra seemed to have lost its cooling power in the sudden melting of the snows. His whisper could not have carried so far, though there was enough ardor in his tone to melt a heart of ice. Antonia turned away abruptly, as if to carry his whispered assurance into the room behind, full of light, noisy with voices. The tide of political speculation was beating high within the four walls of the great sala, as if driven beyond the marks by a great gust of hope. Don Juste's fan-shaped beard was still the center of loud and animated discussions. There was a self-confident ring in all the voices. Even the few Europeans around Charles Gould, a Dane, a couple of Frenchmen, a discreet fat German, smiling, with downcast eyes, the representatives of those material interests that had got a footing in Sulaco under the protecting might of the Santome mine had infused a lot of good humor into their deference. Charles Gould, to whom they were paying their court, was the visible sign of the stability that could be achieved on the shifting ground of revolutions. They felt hopeful about their various undertakings. One of the two Frenchmen, small, black, with glittering eyes lost in an immense growth of bushy beard, waved his tiny brown hands and delicate wrists. He had been traveling in the interior of the province for a syndicate of European capitalists. His forcible Monsieur l'Administrateur returning every minute shrilled above the steady hum of conversations. He was relating his discoveries. He was ecstatic. Charles Gould glanced down at him courteously. At a given moment of these necessary receptions, it was Mrs. Gould's habit to withdraw quietly into a little drawing room, especially her own, next to the great sala. As he had risen, and, waiting for Antonia, listened with a slightly worried graciousness to the engineer-in-chief of the railway, who stooped over her, relating slowly, without the slightest gesture, something apparently amusing, for his eyes had a humorous twinkle. Antonia, before she advanced into the room to join Mrs. Gould, turned her head over her shoulder towards Deckard, only for a moment. "Why should any one of us think his aspirations unrealizable?" she said, rapidly. "I am going to cling to mine to the end, Antonia," he answered, through clenched teeth, then bowed very low, a little distantly. The engineer-in-chief had not finished telling his amusing story. The humors of railway building in South America appealed to his keen appreciation of the absurd, and he told his instances of ignorant prejudice, and as ignorant cunning very well. Now, Mrs. Gould gave him all her attention as he walked by her side escorting the ladies out of the room. Finally, all three passed unnoticed through the glass doors in the gallery. Only a tall priest stalking silently in the noise of the sala, checked himself to look after them. Father Corbelin, whom Deckard had seen from the balcony turning into the gateway of the Casa Gould, had addressed no one since coming in. The long, skimpy Sowton accentuated the tallness of his stature. He carried his powerful torso thrown forward, and the straight, black bar of his joined eyebrows, the pugnacious outline of the bony face, the white spot of a scar on the bluish-shaven cheeks, a testimonial to his apostolic zeal from a party of unconverted Indians, suggested something unlawful behind his priesthood, the idea of a chaplain of bandits. He separated his bony, knotted hands clasped behind his back, to shake his finger at Martin. Deckard had stepped into the room after Antonia. But he did not go far. He had remained just within, against the curtain, with an expression of not quite genuine gravity, like a grown-up person taking part in a game of children. He gazed quietly at the threatening finger. "I have watched Your Reverence converting General Berrios by a special sermon on the plaza," he said, without making the slightest movement. "What miserable nonsense!" Father Corbelin's deep voice resounded all over the room, making all the heads turn on the shoulders. "The man is a drunkard. Sinners, the god of your general is a bottle." His contemptuous, arbitrary voice caused an uneasy suspension of every sound, as if the self-confidence of the gathering had been staggered by a blow. But nobody took up Father Corbelin's declaration. It was known that Father Corbelin had come out of the wilds to advocate the sacred rites of the church with the same fanatical fearlessness with which he had gone preaching to bloodthirsty savages, devoid of human compassion or worship of any kind. Rumors of legendary proportions told of his successes as a missionary beyond the eye of Christian men. He had baptized whole nations of Indians, living with them like a savage himself. It was related that the padre used to ride with his Indians for days, half naked, carrying a bullock-hide shield, and, no doubt, a long lance, to who knows? That he had wandered clothed in skins, seeking for proselytes somewhere near the snow line of the Cordillera. Of these exploits, Padre Corbelin himself was never known to talk. But he made no secret of his opinion that the politicians of Sta. Marta had harder hearts and more corrupt minds than the heathen to whom he had carried the word of God. His injudicious zeal for the temporal welfare of the church was damaging the Ribierist cause. It was common knowledge that he had refused to be made titular bishop of the Occidental diocese till justice was done to a despoiled church. the political chief of Sulaco, the same dignitary whom Captain Mitchell saved from the mob afterwards, hinted with naive cynicism that doubtless their excellencies the ministers sent the padre over the mountains to Sulaco in the worst season of the year in the hope that he would be frozen to death by the icy blasts of the high paramos. Every year a few hardy muleteers, men inured to exposure, were known to perish in that way. But what would you have? Their excellencies possibly had not realized what a tough priest he was. Meantime, the ignorant were beginning to murmur that the Ribierist reforms meant simply the taking away of the land from the people. Some of it was to be given to foreigners who made the railway. The greater part was to go to the padres. These were the results of the Grand Vicar's zeal. Even from the short allocution to the troops on the plaza, which only the first ranks could have heard, he had not been able to keep out his fixed idea of an outraged church waiting for reparation from a penitent country. The political chief had been exasperated. But he could not very well throw the brother-in-law of Don Jose into the prison of the Cabildo. The chief magistrate, an easygoing and popular official, visited the Casa Gould, walking over after sunset from the Intendencia, unattended, acknowledging with dignified courtesy the salutations of high and low alike. That evening he had walked up straight to Charles Gould, and had hissed out to him that he would have liked to deport the Grand Vicar out of Sulaco, anywhere, to some desert island, to the Isabels, for instance. He the one without water preferably, eh, Don Carlos? He had added in a tone between jest and earnest. This uncontrollable priest, who had rejected his offer of the episcopal palace for a residence, and preferred to hang his shabby hammock amongst the rubble and spiders of the sequestrated Dominican convent, had taken into his head to advocate an unconditional pardon for Hernandez the robber. And this was not enough. He seemed to have entered into communication with the most audacious criminal the country had known for years. The Sulaco police knew, of course, what was going on. Padre Corbelan had got hold of that reckless Italian, the Capitas de Cargadores, the only man fit for such an errand, and had sent a message through him. Father Corbelan had studied in Rome, and could speak Italian. The Capitas was known to visit the old Dominican convent at night. An old woman who served the Grand Vicar had heard the name of Hernandez pronounced, and only last Saturday afternoon the Capitas had been observed galloping out of town. He did not return for 2 days. The police would have laid the Italian by the heels, if it had not been for fear of the Cargadores, a turbulent body of men, quite apt to raise a tumult. Nowadays it was not so easy to govern Sulaco. Bad characters flocked into it, attracted by the money in the pockets of the railway workmen. The populace was made restless by Father Corbelan's discourses. And the first magistrate explained to Charles Gould that now the province was stripped of troops any outbreak of lawlessness would find the authorities with their boots off, as it were. Then he went away moodily, to sit in an armchair, smoking a long, thin cigar, not very far from Don Jose, with whom, bending over sideways, he exchanged a few words from time to time. He ignored the entrance of the priest, and whenever Father Corbelan's voice was raised behind him, he shrugged his shoulders impatiently. Father Corbelan had remained quite motionless for a time with that something vengeful in his immobility which seemed to characterize all his attitudes. A lurid glow of strong convictions gave its peculiar aspect to the black figure, but its fierceness became softened as the padre, fixing his eyes upon Decad, raised his long, black arm slowly, impressively, anew. "You are a perfect heathen," he said, in a subdued, deep voice. He made a step nearer, pointing a forefinger at the young man's breast. Decad, very calm, felt the wall behind the curtain with the back of his head. Then, with his chin tilted well up, he smiled. "Very well," he agreed with the slightly weary nonchalance of a man well used to these passages. "Be but is it perhaps that you have not discovered yet what is the god of my worship?" It was an easier task with our burials. The priest suppressed a gesture of discouragement. "Who believe neither in stick nor stone," he said. "Nor bottle," added Deckard without stirring. "Either does the other of your reverence's confidants. I mean the capitas of the cargadors. He does not drink. Your reading of my character does honor to your perspicacity. But why call me a heathen?" "True," retorted the priest. "Why, you are 10 times worse. A miracle could not convert you." "I certainly do not believe in miracles," said Deckard, quietly. Father Corbelin shrugged his high, broad shoulders doubtfully. "A sort of Frenchman, godless, a materialist," he pronounced slowly, as if weighing the terms of a careful analysis. "And neither the son of his own country nor of any other," he continued, thoughtfully. "Scarcely human, in fact," Deckard commented under his breath, his head at rest against the wall, his eyes gazing up at the ceiling. "The victim of this faithless age," Father Corbelin resumed in a deep but subdued voice. "But of some use as a journalist." Deckard changed his pose, and spoke in a more animated tone. "Has your worship neglected to read the last number of the Porvenir? I assure you it is just like the others. On the general policy it continues to call Montero a grand bestia, and stigmatize his brother, the Guerrillero, for a combination of lackey and spy. What could be more effective? In local affairs it urges the provincial government to enlist bodily into the national army the band of Hernandez the robber, who is apparently the protege of the church, or at least of the grand vicar. Nothing could be more sound." The priest nodded and turned on the heels of his square-toed shoes with big steel buckles. Again, with his hands clasped behind his back, he paced to and fro, planting his feet firmly. When he swung about, the skirt of his sou'tan was inflated slightly by the brusqueness of his movements. The great sala had been emptying itself slowly. When the chief politico rose to go, most of those still remaining stood up suddenly in sign of respect, and Don Jose Avellanos stopped the rocking of his chair. But the good-natured first official made a deprecatory gesture, waved his hand to Charles Gould, and went out discreetly. In the comparative peace of the room the screaming Monsieur l'Administrateur of the frail, hairy Frenchman seemed to acquire a preternatural shrillness. The explorer of the capitalist syndicate was still enthusiastic. $10 million worth of copper practically in sight, Monsieur l'Administrateur. 10. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.